Hello, everybody. This is Bill Knauer, and you are listening to Author to Author, where one writer talks to another writer about everything from typos to publishing trends to talking bears. Everything will be on the table, because everything has to be on the table when you are writing. There can be no limitation but your own ceaseless curiosity. Author to Author is brought to you by Author Magazine, the premier free writing magazine on the internet, featuring articles on the writing and the writing life, as well as video and audio interviews with best-selling and award-winning authors across the genres. You can find Author Magazine at authormagazine.org. And Author is funded by the Pacific Northwest Writers Association, supporting writers from pen to publication since 1955. To learn more about the PNWA and their fantastic yearly conference, please go to pnwa.org. Well, today I have our first children's book author to visit Author to Author. I'm welcoming Bonnie Becker to the show. Bonnie's book, A Visitor for Bear, won the E.B. White Read Aloud Award, the Four Award Magazine Book of the Year for Picture Books, the Golden Kite Award for Picture Books, and was selected for the Oprah Children's Book Club. And Bedtime for Bear received the Oppenheim Platinum Best Book Award for 2010. Wow. What do you think of that? I got to get this one on my show. Well, she is on my show. It's Bonnie. Bonnie, welcome to Author to Author.
Hi, thank you.
Bonnie, that's quite a list of awards I just read off. I wasn't aware until I started doing some research. I knew you had had a little attention from the PBS for A Visitor for Bear. But, boy, they just kept coming. What do you think of all that?
Oh, I loved it. It was great. I've been writing for kids. I've been writing all my life, but specifically for kids, about 20 years ago I started. And so to have something like this happen, this much later in my career was just an incredible boost.
Yeah. Well, I should say. Was A Visitor for Bear the first in that series?
Yeah, it was.
It was, yeah. And then Birthday for Bear. I'm sorry, what?
There'll be a total of six.
Wow. So where did the character of Bear, where did he interest you in particular, or was it just another idea that came floating across your prow of your writing boat?
Well, actually, the story started with Mouse, and it's kind of an odd couple relationship where Mouse just keeps, in the first book, Bear is this grumpy loner, and this little mouse shows up at his door and will not go away, no matter how much Bear tries to get rid of him and shut the door on him and tells him to go away. He just pops up unexpectedly and keeps inviting Bear for a bit of tea. And but the thought really started with Mouse, and it really started with thinking about how, some people have problems in their lives that just always seem to come back.
Yes.
Like you'll have a friend who always sort of gets the same bad boss or the same bad boyfriend, even though the names change.
Yeah.
And somehow that, being a writer, that turned into a metaphor. I mean, just literally popped into my head as a mouse who wouldn't go away. So started with him, and I knew right away that that would be fun. In fact, I was a little bit surprised that idea hadn't been used more, this sort of peekaboo. I mean, it's such a natural in kids' writing, and it didn't seem like there had been that, at least recently, that many picture books kind of around that idea. But then the really fun part was picking out who Mouse would bug. And that's when I went through, I thought of an elephant, I thought of a lion, I went through some obvious stuff, and then when I thought of a bear, it was just perfect.
It is perfect, and it's such an interesting, one of the things I love about children's books, and I don't write for children myself, but my wife does, and I find it such an interesting challenge, because to take this sort of fundamental sort of human and life experience, which is that troubles keep coming back to you in certain forms until you deal with them in some way, these sort of ideas like bad bosses, bad girlfriends, bad husbands or wives or whatever, and to reduce them down into something graspable by children. I think it's a great exercise for in a way anyone, but there's something so particular about that.
Well, it's really fun, and with picture books especially, you have to, they really are distilled, and you just have to get to the very essence of something. But at the same time, you have to tell it as metaphor. I mean, you know, I mean, nobody, most stories are metaphor, but especially with kids. I mean, you know, you're not going to discuss how, you know, you need to deal with your problems or they'll keep coming back to you, right? So you really have to distill them down into. But I think that's what storytelling is all about. Making it into a metaphor because, not only is that more interesting, but just to read about. It's way more fun to read about a mouse who won't go away. But it buries it in your head in a different way. I mean, then the reader is taking it into their own head and working it out. And, you know, who knows how it's going to resonate in the reader's head, you know, rather than that literal lesson, you know.
Yeah. I've always thought that the job of the artist is to create what I have termed fertile open space for their audience's imagination, because you can't do everything. You can't say everything. There's too much. But and of course, all storytelling has to be metaphor essentially, because unless you're writing exactly about your own life, you know, you haven't done these things, and yet they're universal. I was just talking to William Landay, who's a crime writer, who's just had his first big breakout crime book. And he said, you know, people, I think it was either him or another. Actually, and I've talked to so many crime writers recently, I think it was he. Doesn't matter. He said that, you know, people who love crime fiction are not themselves criminals. You know, that they haven't murdered anybody, but that or have probably gone through what, say, the victims of a murder, you know, or, you know, say if someone's a husband has been murdered. Most people haven't had that experience, yet they love these stories because they're metaphorical for something else in their lives, perhaps. And it's true for children.
Yeah. And I think it's also, there's an element of vicarious experience, too. You know, I mean, who doesn't want to be inside the head of, well, maybe a lot of people, but a lot of the appeal is being inside the head of, you know, a master criminal mind or inside the head of a detective trying to solve that problem. But I think you're right. It's probably about more than the literal, you know, puzzle that's in the story. You know, it's evoking other things that are going on. You know, with kids, it's impossible to know or for them to articulate what's happening. I do know, and I think every parent does know, that their kid will go through a state, you know, certain books that they want read to them over and over and over again. And there's something going on there, you know. I think the books that usually they want read over and over again do have some idea buried in them. You know, there's something that's being worked through there, that's being looked at there, that can't be put into words yet by the child. So.
Well, but all stories, right? I always think they're emotional experiences. You know, that this is what it feels like to have someone knocking on your door and be surprised, and this is what it feels like to be scared, and then this is what it feels like to be safe. And so these stories must take these children on these emotional journeys, and they, and just like I too can listen to the same songs over and over again, want to take that emotional journey and end up where that story, that journey takes me emotionally and feel it again. Feel there's something to be learned and to relearn and relearn. You know, I must have read Where the Wild Things Are to my son.
Oh, really?
You know, every night for like a year, it seemed like.
Yeah,
but that
I know.
Is such a satisfying experience, that little tiny story, you know.
Well, there's, then he, that Where the Wild Things Are is just, of course, sort of the uber, you know, picture book example of that, where something, you know, deeper psychologically is obviously being worked with there. And, you know, it's so powerful to go off to Where the Wild Things Are. You know, what little kid doesn't have that in them, you know? And the anger that's in them, the anarchy that's in them. And, of course, the brilliance about that book is being able to go out to that and then come back home again.
And the meal is still hot.
The meal is still hot. I think actually it was the meal is still warm.
And it was still warm, yeah.
Yeah. the only reason I quibble about that is he. I've read some things by him, and he was adamant about that word warm. They wanted to change it to hot. I hope we've got it right. But I think they wanted to change it to hot, and just something about the word warm was what felt right to him.
Well, you know what? If you've got so few words in your book, I can see the book on the shelf behind me, but I can't reach it, and we could have checked.
I know. We've probably gotten it backward. But
No, I'll bet it's warm. I'll bet it is. Well, I don't know. I'd have to check and see. You know, speaking of Sendak, do you ever watch the Colbert Report?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Did you see his deal with him?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. That was just wonderful.
It was very funny. Yeah. For our listeners who maybe didn't see it, Colbert did a two-part interview with Maurice Sendak, but it was predicated on the idea that, and the reason I bring it up is Colbert wanted to, I guess it actually may even, publish a children's book because he said, my qualifications are, I'm a celebrity, and that was the end of his qualifications because it seems like every celebrity is writing a children's book. So
there is this
idea, I think we might have talked about this before when we did our interview a couple years back, that writing for children is easy.
Yeah.
You know, the argument goes along the lines of like, look, you know, for instance, you write children's picture books, which means that in terms of pure text, you're only writing, what, 400 or 500 words maybe?
Yeah, 800
words
at the most.
70,000 as opposed to, you know, 100,000. And how hard can that be? And yada, yada, yada. You must hear that from time to time. I think that people certainly think that looking at them.
Yeah.
But it's not the truth, is it?
No, it's not the truth. But what I really like to do is, you know, if I'm kind of getting that feeling or response is to say, yeah, really, it is easy. Go write one.
Go do one, yeah.
Go do one. You know, I'm sounding snarkier than I really send it across, but as soon as you start trying to do one and are sincere about one that works and you might even actually get published, you do start to discover how hard it is. And I mean, I had to discover that for myself, too, when I started in picture books. I mean, I did the same thing I think almost everybody does, is they read a ton of them to their kids, and how hard can this be? And, of course, it turned out to be incredibly hard. And you know, the best way to think about it is as poetry.
That's just what I was thinking. Because essentially that's what you're writing, especially if it's a true picture book.
Yes. So every word counts, and it does have to contain that idea. I like to say that picture books are easy. All they have to be is simple but profound. And
right.
Try to get those two things together. You know, again, I think like the mouse idea, I knew right away it had the kernel of something that would make a good picture book. And it takes a while. I think one of the hardest things about picture books is finding an idea that does have that kernel, that's got something that's going to resonate beyond the obvious story. And you kind of just know it when you find it.
But I would think it's like anything else, whether you're writing for children or adult, that you have to tap into what is of interest to you. Just because you aren't a child
it
doesn't mean that you don't address, you know, because I have two boys, and what I have seen is that they, especially when they were younger, they are just humans, not so much in miniature, but in a kind of like a microcosm in a way. It's the same challenges, but just reduced down in this certain way. But they're still, you know, they would come to me, you know, they were particularly philosophical, but they would come staggering out of their beds at 10:30 at night as I was getting ready to go to bed and say, Dad, what happens when I die? And, you know, and what, you know, is the, when I remember my oldest son was 5 when the Twin Towers went down.
Oh, my God,
and,
yeah.
You know, so, and he had this pretend world, you know, called Egindu, and everybody died in it. Everybody died. And I was like, no.
After the...
Yes, he said, they're all dead. And I was like, well, that's bad. I know, but then about a week later, I saw him playing in Egindu. I said, there's some people alive. He said, yes, they didn't all die. It was survival of the yokiest.
Oh, my God.
That was my son. That was how he was. But that world.
That's how he processed it.
That's how he processed it. And I think one of the biggest mistakes you can make writing for kids, even though I don't, but my wife does it, and I've seen it again and again with the authors I've talked to, is to presume that these kids aren't interested in sophisticated topics, but translated in a way that they can understand, but that they don't have complex, that they don't feel the same pain, same sense of loss, the same desire for love. It can't be any different just because they're young.
No, it's the same questions. It's just that they – they are coming at them completely fresh. I mean, completely
yeah.
new. It's the first time that question's ever been asked, you know, in their world, and their, you know, what happens to you after you die. I do think the answers or how it gets posed is different. It's not just that it's simplified. It's that the younger the child is, the kid is, I think the more reassurance you want to present in your answer. They are not ready yet for, you know, Anna Karenina, you know. They're not ready yet for tragedy. And the way I think of kids writing is, or a big part of kids writing is encouragement in sort of the literal sense of the word, which is giving people courage to live, you know. So you're born, you come into this world, you have no idea what's going on, you're a stranger in a strange land.
Right.
The first thing you don't want to hear is, oh, my God, get out of here.
Right.
You made a terrible mistake. You know, what
no,
you want
true.
To hear is, yeah, come on in. You know, you can do it. You can. Here's all these stories about people who face hard things and make it, and your parents love you, people love you, you will be taken care of. You know, that's not obviously 100% true, but,
well,
you know, mostly
you
they
know
need
what,
encouragement.
I agree, and I feel like sometimes – I was talking to, I'm drawing a blank left and right, but a wonderful children's book author whose name escapes me right now. But we were talking about the penchant for adult writers to be so, to present such a harsh, a sort of harsher view of the world, and to see that perspective that we offer children about the possibility of life being sort of limitless,
mm-hmm.
essentially, as Pollyanna. And I think to some degree adult writers do themselves a disservice by presuming we have to be so sort of gritty about everything, that
mm-hmm.
life, to present life as this very sort of hard test that we have to endure, and
yeah.
as if what we're saying to children is, you know, we're just sugarcoating things until they learn the truth, you know. But
oh,
in fact,
yes, that's
I think
a good point.
And in fact, I had a friend of mine wanted to write an article for the magazine. He was having a hard time, but he had a young daughter. I said, look, here's how I write my columns for author. I try to think of the very best. I pick some topic that I'm going to have to do it every day, but I pick some topic, and then I think to myself, and it's not unlike, I think, what people go through writing for children. I say, what's the very best thing I can say about this? And I said to my friend Chris, I said, imagine you were writing this to your daughter. What would you want to tell her about this writing experience? Because you wouldn't want to tell her, suck it up because it's all hell from here, you know. You just wouldn't say
right,
it. And there's
right,
a reason
exactly.
for that. There's a reason for that. And it's not just because we're trying to protect them from the truth. I don't buy it.
No.
I don't buy it.
Yes. And you don't need to dish it out to them. I mean, there is that doesn't mean it's just completely sappy and sunshine. Where it gets real is that you address real questions. Death is a real tough one in kids' writing, and
sure.
especially in the picture books. You don't see much working with that. The difference between when you're writing a good book for kids, you're asking real questions. It's not encouraging to have somebody deny that that you're going to die. Or deny things that you see as obvious truth, that unfair things happen. So if you pretend that doesn't happen in your writing, then you're lying. But if you, and kids can smell that a long way off. I mean, you'll read it to them the first time and they'll like it, but they'll never ask for it again.
That's right.
But if you acknowledge in your story that, yeah, we're, you know, people are different, people are weird, you're not three anymore, and it's not, you know, not everybody loves you, you're getting some frowns from somebody, if you acknowledge that in your writing, but then show the character dealing with it and figuring it out, that's encouragement.
Yes. Absolutely. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh, I was just going to say that, you know, as you get older, you know, you can start dealing with more complex possibilities. But I also agree, you don't have to be, by the time you're 30, everything doesn't have to be horrible. I mean, and that's the only legitimate literature and the only legitimate stories. Most great literature is very melodramatic with ridiculously impossible happy endings. And so, you know, like Charles Dickens.
Right.
you know, you would just, if you stripped it down to the bare story, it would just be laughably sentimental.
It's true, and the fact is, it is, while it is dishonest to paint a sort of happy face on everything, it's also dishonest to say that all of life ends in disappointment
and
that
despair.
People don't fall in love and despair. You know, Martin Luther King said something great in his, I just found it so, in fact, I heard it. Of all, I had never heard his Nobel acceptance speech. It's a great speech. And where did I hear it? My son's third grade got up and each recited a line from it on Martin Luther King Day. So we had gone for this thing, and my son's doing it. And he had this line. You know, he was saying, I'm here to accept this award. And then he listed all the things he would not accept. And one of them, he said, I will not accept despair as the final answer to history's enduring mystery.
Ooh.
Wow.
Yeah.
It gets right there. And that's not, and it's not the truth. The fact is, the only thing is that kids, rightfully, because they are fresh on this earth, are not concerned with death overly unless they are surrounded by it. But the chances are they are not. Whereas adults, we start to look at it and we start to have people die and we start saying, well, what about us? And a lot of literature deals with death because that's a question that hangs over us. But it does not mean despair is the end.
No, it is the question. But I agree. When I was little, once in a while, all of us, right? Once in a while you'd realize that there's this thing called death out there.
Yeah.
I didn't want to, again, you'll see it dealt with a little bit in picture books, but very gently and usually geared at a child who has experienced the death of a pet.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
A parent will want it and bring it in. But otherwise,
you're there to live. You know, I cannot stand the perspective. One of the things I go on about this sometimes. I love evolution because I love that things change and I see change happening all around me. So I love everything about evolution except the idea that somehow we evolve not towards love, which is towards life, but away from death. So in other words, evolution occurs simply for us to avoid dying, that all of life is just this, who can delay death the longest and make the most babies? I don't buy it. I know
that's
death is sad, but life not simply avoiding death. I'm not interested.
Well,
who cares?
I'm intrigued by a lot of that, too. I think one of the, you know, people will say that meaning is being imposed on something, but it sure seems kind of irrefutable that life has progressed from simpler to more complex and from less conscious to more conscious, you know, and what's that got to do with it? You know, why would it even matter if you ever change from a one cell to a four cell?
Why does life want to keep living and living and living? Why is it so important that life keep living? And it ain't just
why would a bunch of chemicals care, you know?
Yeah,
what would ever make a bunch of chemicals struggle to survive?
Yeah. No, I think it's beautiful when viewed that way. And the more I see it, in fact, my son, my youngest son, who was diagnosed on the autism spectrum, was talking to me about, evolution, in fact. We were watching this thing on The Simpsons. And Homer, it was the beginning. And so for this humorous beginning where they show evolution from the amoebas up to monkeys and then to man, and then it de-evolution, then de-evolves.
Back to Homer.
Right, so that's the joke, right?
Yeah.
And he had never heard of it. He said, "What's evolution?" And I said, "Oh, he hadn't heard." So I explained what it was to him, and then he paused, and he said something I have never heard asked. He said, "Well, so what will humans evolve into?"
Mm-hmm.
As if we are done, right?
Yeah.
We've reached it. This is the end of it right here.
Yeah.
And my first thought was, well, you, because you guys show up, and now we're all having to change everything so much around you people, these new kids who are, and then, you know, this supposed epidemic, you know. So, but I'd never heard that asked.
Yeah.
I'd never heard it.
We're bound to evolve into something, you know. It doesn't stop here. Well, if you ask my husband, he'd say robots, you know.
Oh, God.
I know. We argue about this all the time. But at the same time, obviously, we're not done. You know, there's lots of thinkers, especially contemporary thinking, that thinks the evolution is going to happen on a consciousness level, not so much a, you know.
I think it already is. And in fact, you can look at government. I mean, even isn't human society evolved? I mean, isn't democracy an evolution from you know, despotism, where just the guy with the big stick ran everything. Now you have everybody voting. Well, that's new. You know, we didn't do that a thousand years
Hopefully
ago.
Hopefully that's progress, you know, yes.
I think it is.
I agree. I remember in the 60s and 70s, when understandably where the thinking was trying to kind of level out and not have white Americans think that they knew it all and starting to recognize the value in other ways of life and stuff. But there was also this trend to just say that none of this was progress. There was no such thing as progress,
right?
In essence, and you know, tell that to the mom who even 60 years ago is watching her child with polio, you know, struggle with polio, or the millions of women who have died in childbirth for thousands and thousands of years. I mean, they're I assume that's better, you know.
Of course,
to have your child live, you know.
But when would you have wanted to live besides right now? Would you want to live 100? You know, I had these friends who would say, well, it was better in the 50s, man. I was like, yeah, it was better in the 50s if you were a white guy.
But
the women were in the kitchen, the blacks were in the back of the bus, and the gays were in the closet. There were nice things about it, but there was a lot that needed. There was a reason the 60s happened, and it wasn't an accident.
I think, as far as I can tell, most of the golden ages were whenever you were a kid. because it is. I mean, and actually this ties back to kids writing. I think for all sorts of reasons, including just literally chemical, you know, your brain chemistry, life is different as a kid. And it has, I mean, for most people, not all, it has this golden glow and this level of experience and intensity and meaningfulness that, you know, you try later in life to recapture. And, you know, why isn't Christmas like it was when I was a kid?
Right, right.
And it really, it almost can't be, you know. You're just almost a different creature.
Well, you become, you have to do it. The thing I've come around to understand is that in my adulthood, what I am trying to do is to recapture the sort of, because one of the things about being a kid is you're so in the moment. You know, I didn't spend a lot of time worrying about the past or fretting about the future.
No.
And then you get to be an adult and suddenly there's all this threat and then
all you're doing.
All the mortgage and other. And what I've learned is sort of my spiritual evolution is that I'm trying to recapture that ability, but with the consciousness of an adult. You know, I can't unlearn what I've learned, but to try to return to that, but as a conscious person, as opposed to just a newly sort of unconscious person. And it can be done. It can
well,
be
I
done.
Like, to me, that ties into the creative process because I think ultimately you become an artist. You do marry those two things. And, you know, you can't go by just, let's call it the unconscious rather than the kid alone. I mean, you get these fabulous pictures that 5- and 6-year-olds draw, which is wonderful.
That's right.
But if you don't get that grown up, you don't get, Michelangelo.
That's right.
You've got to have the inspiration and then I think ideally you end up being able to blend those two. You know, they're called all sorts of different names, the critic and the muse and the staying a child forever isn't the solution.
No, it's not. You want to grow up. There's a reason we all want to grow up. But then you become conscious and you become in command. Now you're in the world and you can take care of yourself and maintain that sort of low. I mean, Picasso said everybody is born an artist. Just that some people unlearn that. Doesn't mean you have to be a visual artist, but within everybody is the artist. Well, that is an excellent note on which to end this fabulous conversation.
Okay.
We went all kinds of places. I didn't know where we'd go,
but
it was good. Bonnie, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
What book should everybody look for if they've got a kid they want to read to? What's the latest book?
Look for the Mouse and Bear books, A Visitor for Bear, A Bedtime for Bear, A Birthday for Bear, and the latest is The Sniffles for Bear.
The Sniffles for Bear. Okay, everybody, go out and get one for every little kid you know. You know, thanks so much, Bonnie.
Thank you.
Well, and thank you, everybody, for listening in. It's been another great episode of Author to Author. I'm going to be going now, but come back next week, and we'll have Stephanie Kallos visiting with us. In the meantime, make sure that you do only what you love. Write what you love, eat what you love, read what you love. Never go wrong.